Last Wednesday, as I'm prone to do, I anticipated a feast day. In this occasion or that occasion on last Wednesday, I anticipated the feast of St. Matthew, which was recognized a couple of days ago on Friday. The apostle and evangelist Matthew is a man claimed to have written the first gospel in the New Testament. And we know little about him other than what we read in the gospel that bears his name. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth and said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. In the time of Jesus, tax collectors were a despised breed. No one liked them. They were independent agents appointed by the Roman authorities to collect the taxes. And they earned their living by adding a commission to the tax they collected. So Romans of every stamp thought them nothing less than thieves. And the Jews hated them because they worked for the Romans. They served the occupiers of Israel. They were traitors to the Jewish race. Well, this traitor, this thief, in the person of Matthew, Jesus invited to follow me. And Matthew obeyed and invited Jesus to his house for a meal. Imagine, if a Roman soldier had ordered Matthew to follow me, we can imagine Matthew being rather nervous. If a Pharisee had ordered Matthew to follow me, he might have been suspicious at the least, if not frightened. We read of Pharisees being known to stone traitors. But seemingly, Matthew had no such fears in following Jesus and inviting him into his house. Perhaps there was something about Jesus that set Matthew's mind at rest. And the feeling apparently was infectious. Matthew's friends followed him and shared the meal. Matthew then disappears from the pages of history. Anything else we know of him, even the belief that he wrote the gospel which bears his name, is the stuff of legend. But it is enough. It's always helpful, in fact I talked about this just a few moments ago in the confirmation class, it's always helpful to realize that there is more to a piece of writing than just the writing itself. There is what we call a context, a meta-narrative, a narrative behind the narrative. Just think of ordinary letters that we write to friends and write to relations. There's always something behind it, more than just the letter itself. And what is true of ordinary writings, books, novels, histories, biographies, you name them, is also true of the scriptures. They don't stand in isolation. They were not created in a vacuum. There was something going on that prompted the writer or writers to set down what they set down. And one thing that we have learnt through history and through other writings is that after the crucifixion, the Jews rose in revolt against the Romans with disastrous results. It's known as the Jewish Wars. And Jerusalem was sacked. The temple was destroyed. As a branch of Judaism, the Sadducees disappeared from history. And the Pharisees were left in disarray until round about 70 AD or 71 AD, when they began to reform. In other words, everything was not as it seemed. And in one form or another, all of this is reflected in the Gospel of Matthew. Not only the story of Jesus and who Jesus is, but a history of the early church as it sought to find its own identity. Although it's been shown that the Gospel of Mark was the first to be written, the early church has always considered Matthew to be the first of the Gospels. The Gospel of the Church, looking back to a time when the whole world was in upheaval, yet a time when Jesus called, "Follow me." Well, in the Gospel reading for this Sunday, we've moved on a little bit from last week, when Jesus asked us the deepest of all questions, "Who do you say that I am?" And we sort of came out with a rather loose idea that Jesus is to whoever we want Jesus to be for ourselves. We've moved on from Jesus' invitation to Matthew to follow me. This Sunday, Jesus catches the disciples arguing about who is the greatest. So Jesus offers a moral lesson about powerlessness and innocence, about humility and vulnerability. He places a child before them. So often, this passage is used as a proof text for churches to accept children. And there's nothing wrong in that. But that is not what the first hearers of the Gospel of Mark would have understood. In Roman times, actually right the way through to medieval times, right through to the Industrial Revolution, children were considered nothing more than objects. The 20th century view of children is modern. Children were farmed out. In Roman times, if a child was born and was not wanted, they were left outside to die. The romantic view we have of children is modern. It was not so in the Industrial Revolution and in the centuries before. Children were dependent on others, subject to the authority of their elders. Children were powerless and of no value at all. The complex Roman world functioned on a system of patronage. It still does. Just think of the maxim, it's not what you know, it's who you know that matters. That's another form of patronage. And children had no value. There was nothing to be gained from receiving a child, which is precisely the point Jesus was making to his disciples, quarreling about status and position. When Jesus embraced the child in the midst of his disciples, he was transcending age and culture, showing them that in the kingdom of heaven, the common things of life are reversed, where the least in the earthly kingdom will be first, and the first last. You know, I thought of a modern example of that. I shared it with the 8 o'clockers some 3 general conventions ago. My colleague and friend David Lovelace, who was until recently rector of St. John's in York, he and I were at general convention, and they always have seminary banquets. And so we went to our seminary banquet, and it just so happened that a brand new bishop sat next to us. You know, we could tell he was brand new. First of all, we knew him. He went to our seminary, and secondly, his purple shirt glowed. And he sat next to us. And we thought, well, that's nice, you know. And we started to chat with him. And then we noticed that he wasn't looking at us. He was looking around. And 10 minutes later, he got up and left. He'd found a table where there were people of more worth than we lowly clerics. We don't even know we're doing it when we're doing it. The child represents the vulnerability and the powerlessness in all of us. Jesus had nothing to gain when he invited Matthew, the tax collector, to eat with him. Nothing, that is, except the hatred of the Pharisees. But he extended the invitation nonetheless, and it changed Matthew's life forever. Jesus had nothing to gain when he placed before the disciples that little child. Yet the disciples gained everything. Jesus had nothing to gain, has nothing to gain, when he extends the invitation to you and to me to follow him. Yet he extends the invitation anyway. And there's a cost in all of this. As Matthew and the rest of the disciples were to discover, it is not easy to follow Jesus. It's not easy to go against the gold. It's not easy to go against all the values of the modern age and follow the values of Jesus. It's not easy to follow Jesus when we're so caught up in our own lives. The former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, once suggested that the hardest thing in the world is to be where we are. And what I think he means by that is that when we live in troubled times, even the church seems not to be the beacon of hope it ought to be, but rather a place that reflects the passions of the time. We don't live in a vacuum. We bring the world in with us. We don't leave it at the door. We bring in our biases, our opinions, our likes and our dislikes, our fears, our joys and our challenges. We bring them in here. Whenever I talk to my sister at home and we get onto the subject of religion, even though I'm a priest and she's very proud of what I do, she says, I don't go to church. It's full of hypocrites. I said, you're dead right. That's why we're here. We are hypocrites. We preach one thing out of one side of our mouths and we do something different out the other. Sometimes the hardest thing to be is where we are. Because the place to bring all those things is right there. Right there. And then you leave them there. And you go out and start anew. That's what recreation means. Starting anew. That's what confession means. And absolution means. Starting anew. The hardest thing in the world is to be where we are. I think this is what the early church must have felt, caught up in the middle of these dreadful wars that were going on in their own time, when nothing somehow seemed what it should be. This is what they must have been struggling with, I think. When they read about Jesus inviting Matthew to follow me, or struggled with the question Jesus asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And yet, Rowan Williams goes on to say that this ordinary time, we're now in actually ordinary time. You know that? The season of Pentecost is known in the liturgical terms as ordinary time. It's not a major festival. It's not an Advent. It's not Christmas. It's not Easter. It's not Epiphany. We are in ordinary time. We're in this mundane, everyday time of our lives, where we go to work, we go to school, we attend to the many tasks that confront us. This is the time where we are. What we need to remember is it is a gift from God, a gift, an invitation, if you will, to accept Jesus' invitation to follow me and to live into his wisdom. For in God's wisdom lies peace, in God's wisdom lies forgiveness, in God's wisdom lies mercy, in God's wisdom all things hold together. Last Thursday night, Bishop Scanlon was with us as we gathered for preparation for the Diocesan Convention. And she talked about a new initiative that she has, Bishop Out of the Box. A bishop out of the box is doing something very unepiscopal. It's actually going out into the world and going up to someone and saying, so, can I pray for you? How would you feel doing that? Okay, this is the time you can all look down and look at your shoes. How would you feel going out and just going up to a stranger and saying, so can I pray for you? That's what she did. They set up their camp outside the cathedral and they just waited to see if anybody would turn up. And of course, you know, people walk by and they think, oh, it must be one of those sects. You know? And eventually, Audrey saw this chap coming down the walking path outside the cathedral near the river, and she walked up to him and she said, could I pray for you? He was there for 40 minutes. He'd just come out of prison. He was just trying to start life anew. And someone actually walked up to him and said, can I pray for you? Can I be with you? Can I help you? Then he took a little child and put it among them. And taking it in his arms, he said to them, whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me, welcomes not me, but the one who sent me. We are all children of God. And the hardest thing in the world is to be where we are. Wherever we are, imagine what that child must have felt when placed in the midst of the disciples and in the arms of Jesus. Imagine how Matthew must have felt, sitting in his tax booth in troubled times, when Jesus called to him, follow me. I often think if the hardest thing in the world is to be where we are, sometimes it is just as hard to leave it. Because even in the hardest of times, the only security we have is the bubble we're in. And sometimes it's hard to be invited out of that bubble. Last Wednesday, I got a call from one of my former staff members. 30-odd years ago now, 40 years ago, he worked for me. In fact, we laughed. He's 62 now. He was 22 when he worked for me. Do you know why he called? He's in London, by the way. He called me on the computer. Because he's depressed. A relationship has just crashed. He's lonely. He doesn't know how he's going to face Christmas. He doesn't know how he's going to face the next day. And where he works, he's always been known as a fellow who's joyous and he's always good for cracking jokes. He said, I just can't do that anymore. So he said, I thought I had to call you. And we talked for 40 minutes. And I suggested a few things. And he said, I can't do that. I don't know that I want to do that. I don't know that I know how to do that. So we've arranged he's going to call me again in a couple of weeks. Sometimes it's just as hard to leave the place where we are, even though it's hard to be in the place where we are. But the irony is, that's where Jesus is. Where we are is where Jesus is, inviting us to follow me. And when we stay close to the heart of Jesus, we stay close to the love of God. That's why we call the Gospels the Evangelion, the good news of Jesus Christ. Amen.